Thursday, June 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, new charges in the death of George Floyd, including the three other officers involved.
Charges of police officer King, Lane, and Tao with aiding and abetting murder in the second degree, a felony offense.
Some religious leaders express outrage at what they call a political stunt by the president.
Kind of choreographed photo op designed on the one hand and a kind of show of force and dominance, and then to use a church as a set and a Bible as a prop.
Also ahead, a Paris court rules on where the case against a Rwandan genocide suspect will be heard. It's all on today's International Edition. Prosecutors on Wednesday filed a tougher charge against the police officer at the center of the George Floyd case and charged the three other officers on scene. The announcement delivered a victory to protesters galvanized by the videotaped death that ignited underlying racial tensions and unleashed coast-to-coast unrest. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison.
To the Floyd family, to our beloved community, and to everyone that is watching, I say, George Floyd mattered. He was loved. His family was important. His life had value. And we will seek justice for him and for you, and we will find it.
Ellison said he will also work to change what is a bigger issue of systemic racism and unequal justice. He said George Floyd should be here right now.
I filed an amended complaint that charges former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin with murder in the second degree for the death of George Floyd. I believe the evidence available to us now supports the stronger charge of second-degree murder.
Joining us to talk more about the charges is Minneapolis-based criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, you know the players, you know the system in Minneapolis and Minnesota. How significant are these developments?
It's a massive shift. The fact that he has been charged with second-degree unintentional murder means a lot in terms of how you would prosecute a case like this. If we think back to some of the information we received from the medical examiner and even that second autopsy, that can go to this issue. It's also something that's far more serious in terms of time that one could spend if they're convicted of a charge. We then go to those other three officers, the fact that they're going to be charged with aiding and abetting. It's hard to tell where that's going to go necessarily, but I think what really is going to happen in the short and long term is that the prosecutors really want to see some cooperation from those three officers, because they really want to go after the man who had his knee on the neck of George Floyd for almost 8 minutes. It's a very big deal. And so it's a good shift. And I think people are happy that this is a serious prosecution.
This is a big deal to have such charges brought against police officers, is it not?
It's very serious. And in fact, what we found from Attorney General Ellison was that this isn't just about the charges that are being brought. The real question now is, how do you prove it? And I understand that a lot of people will look at the videotape and just say, let the videotape run. But there are some realities that we have seen in this country where police officers have been charged and they walk. They walk again and again and again. So a big part of this is about the perception of juries and what juries are saying, what they should or should not be doing in cases like these. And so the real issue is about making sure that you have a very strong prosecution that lays out all of the evidence from those who were on the street, trying to get the other officers involved in terms of supporting the prosecution, having the videotape, doing everything that must be done to ensure that they're able to successfully actually prosecute this to a conviction. And that is something that's harder than you would imagine when you consider the number of people who are out there who sometimes want to let police officers do whatever they want. And so that can be pretty scary too.
And that, of course, goes to the bigger picture of why the protesters peacefully are still out there across the country saying they are happy that this has happened, that their voices have been heard, but that there is more to say and there needs to be systemic change across the country about the way that African Americans are treated.
There are people who will continue to stay in the streets, continuing to put pressure on the government to not just take this seriously, but to follow through with the prosecutions. But more importantly, to address the systemic problems that this grew out of from in the first place when it comes to how the police focus upon who they hire, how they train them, how they continue to train them, how they deal with questions of ethics, how they deal with questions of oversight, how they deal with questions of transparency.
Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. The attorney for Floyd's family called it a bittersweet moment and a significant step forward on the road to justice. The move, punctuating an unprecedented week in modern American history, saw largely peaceful protests, but were also rocked by bouts of violence, including deadly attacks on officers, rampant looting, and arson in some places. Mainstream Protestant and Catholic leaders across the U.S. sharply criticized President Trump this week after peaceful protesters were forcibly displaced for a presidential photo in front of a church where he held up a Bible. Trump has been trying to appeal to evangelical Christian voters just months ahead of the November elections when he hopes to win a second term. Joining us for analysis is Robert P. Jones, CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute, and author of the upcoming book, White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. What is your reaction to what we saw this week?
I think the straightforward thing to say is that it was a political stunt. You know, it was a kind of choreographed photo op designed, you know, to show him clearing the streets on the one hand, and a kind of show of force and dominance, which is the word that he has used over and over, and then to use a church as a set and a Bible as a prop. And so, you know, I think we've seen rightly religious leaders kind of across the board be disturbed by this. It's notable that he didn't read from the Bible. He didn't quote from the Bible. He didn't go into the church, a fairly thin attempt at wrapping his actions in Christianity and appealing to his base, which is really a white Christian base in the country. And the language of law and order, him talking about violent protesters being doing things against the law of God, you know, really is aligning himself with God, with white Christianity. And, you know, there was no mention of George Floyd in any of his remarks, really only mentions, kind of racialized mentions of violence. And then I think standing here in front of a white mainline Protestant church and holding up a Bible really was intended to be just a symbolic act, really intended mostly for his white evangelical base.
The reverend of the church, the Episcopal bishop, called it antithetical to the teachings of Jesus and everything churches stand for. What do you believe she meant by that?
Well, you know, I think maybe the most important thing she said in her comments that were quoted in the New York Times was that the Bible's not an American document. You know, and I think that's the way that it got used in that event. As it got used as a not just an American prop, but as a partisan prop. And I think that's the reason why it did not sit so well with so many religious Americans and religious leaders. And in particular, I think, you know, the juxtaposition of, you know, evidently the leaders of the church had no idea that he was going to, you know, use their church as a backdrop. And in fact, on the other side of the church, he was on the front side, on the back side of the church, members of the church were actually handing out water to the protesters that were there. So it was just this really odd juxtaposition and clearly caught the church leaders off guard, and clearly not where they saw their own ministry and their understanding of Christianity, you know, positioning them very differently than the president.
And then, of course, the violent clearing of the protesters in order to do this, that seemed in stark contradiction of what the people of faith were saying.
That's absolutely right. And I should say that by all measures, it looks like that was a very intentional staged clearing. You know, my offices are only a few blocks from there. I know that area very well. I've spoken at St. John's Church, and there really is only a cross street there between Lafayette Park and the church. And the White House had military police staking out the perimeter of the park. And all they would have had to have done is extend that fencing, say, another 50 feet to cross that street. And they could have had a pre-prepared path cleared for the president that would not have required rubber bullets, flashbangs, and people on horseback proceeding in a pretty threatening way against peaceful protesters there. I think that part of it could have been easily avoided. And I think was intentionally not avoided. I think that President Trump, you know, evidently wanted that image of a forceful clearing of peaceful protesters. What he's done there, I think, is to try to juxtapose and present these moves to clear peaceful protesters as something that is sanctioned by a church, sanctioned by the Bible, and ultimately sanctioned by God. And that's certainly not how the leaders of that church understood their mandate.
Right. I heard the word sacrilegious a lot.
It is literally across the street from the White House. And, you know, anytime if President Trump wanted to pay his respects to the church, you know, they did have a small fire set that was put out. If he wanted to pay his respects to the leaders of the church, he could have done that anytime, right, during the day, walked over there with Secret Service detail. It would have been a very easy thing to arrange. And this was all very clearly just a staged photo op.
Do you think this is something people are going to remember more than a lot of other things that have happened?
Well, it's such a stark and frankly awkward move by the president. So, you know, I think it will be memorable just for I think, how baldly utilitarian it was, and really without a lot of religious substance. It really was holding up the Bible as a kind of talisman or totem, as opposed to the Word of God and the guiding principles of Christianity. It really had no substance to it. It really was just holding it up as an object of power. And I think because it was so baldly used, and that it was so racially charged, I think that's the other piece of it. It was so aligning the Bible and white Christianity over again against protests for justice for an African-American man who was killed by police.
Do you think that the evangelical Christians that support Trump think completely differently about what he did?
I don't think they'll have a problem with it. They have been so with Trump from the beginning, and we've been tracking Trump's favorability among religious groups and particularly among white evangelicals really on a weekly and monthly basis since before the election in 2016. And since he's been president, their favorability has never dipped below the low 60s, and it has been as high as 81%. That is true for impeachment. That isn't true even in these last months. We have data coming out of the field now that's showing very similar numbers. So most of them, I don't think, will be turned off by this.
Robert P. Jones, CEO and founder of PRRI, or the Public Religion Research Institute, and author of the upcoming book, White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity, coming out in August. Thank you for being with us. Europeans have been taking to the streets in solidarity with those protesting the issue of violence by police against Black people in the U.S. And like America, European nations have had cases of minorities dying at the hands of white police officers, but those have rarely resulted in mass demonstrations. Martha Vanderwolf reports from Amsterdam that that could be changing.
About 5,000 demonstrators came together in Amsterdam this week in solidarity with the demonstrations following the death of George Floyd. The crowd was diverse, and many people were holding signs with slogans such as Black Lives Matter and I Can't Breathe. Joukje Boder is a demonstrator who has taken part in anti-racism protests in Amsterdam before. Boder, who is white, says it's important for everyone to participate in these kinds of protests to combat racism in societies everywhere.
Well, the problem with European racism is that it's more invisible and more institutionalized than in America, where maybe it's more explicit. And I think in Europe it's more subtle in, I don't know, small ways. So I think it's harder to make people aware of that it's as big of a problem in Europe than it is in America, or as it is in America.
More demonstrations are planned in the Netherlands and in many other European cities in coming days. A protest that was to happen in Paris Tuesday evening was banned, but tens of thousands of people still took to the streets. The French protest was also in memory of Adama Traoré, a young Black Frenchman who died in police custody in 2016. The officers involved in Traoré's death were recently exonerated, as initial medical reports had stated he died of heart failure, a claim contested by two other medical investigations. Karen Taylor, chair of the Brussels-based European Network Against Racism, ENAR, says discussing the topic of racism in Europe is difficult, but she sees the US protests as having a positive effect on our efforts.
We see that people are trying to build the link between what is happening in the US and to shed light on what is happening here in Europe. And I think that's exactly where white allies can join in the fight. And of course, whenever they post something in solidarity with which is happening in the US, to remind people about what is going on in Europe, and that it's not all about the U.S. context.
Incidents in the United States grab the headlines when it comes to issues of racial inequality and police violence against minorities, but it is clear Europe has its own problems. Protests erupted in Britain in 2011 after police shot Mark Duggan, a 29-year-old British-born man of African-Caribbean descent. But a police investigation ruled the killing by police was lawful, and a high court agreed with the rationale the officer acted in self-defense. Protesters in London this week held up signs with the names of many other Black British people who died in police incidents. A Dutch monitoring group on racial profiling, Control Alt Delete, says 41 people died when in contact with Dutch police since 2016, and that not one officer was called into court. The French collective Urgence Notre Police Assassine states that of the 103 people killed by police between 2005 and 2015, 95% were of Black or Arab descent. Both ANAR and Amnesty International say many European countries lack independent oversight mechanisms to investigate allegations of police brutality. Amnesty's Marco Perolini says Europe has serious human rights issues when it comes to racial discrimination and policing.
So one of them is racial profiling, so the fact that ethnic minorities are stopped and searched by the police more often than white people. This is a human rights issue at the regional level in Europe and in all European countries. A second one is the fact that there are still a lot of instances where police use force unlawfully. And then a third issue that is particularly problematic is the fact that we have noticed and observed a lack of accountability for allegations of excessive use of force, unlawful use of force by police.
An upcoming report from Amnesty International looks at how police disproportionately targeted ethnic communities in 12 European countries during the coronavirus lockdown. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Amsterdam.
And despite the new charges against the officers involved in the death of George Floyd, protests continue across the U.S., which is also slowly coming out of another crisis, a pandemic that has taken a historic economic and public health toll. U.S. governors told lawmakers the first phase of reopening the country is going well, but more resources are still needed. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more on the ongoing impact of the coronavirus.
Thousands marching in cities across the nation, closely packed in with each other, causing concerns the protests could trigger a second wave of the coronavirus. Expanded testing will help prevent that spread, said the head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force.
So that the individuals who are involved in the peaceful protests can get tested and really know their status before they unknowingly spread it.
The virus has killed more than 105,000 people in the U.S., disproportionately impacting people of color. As those protests are happening, voters in eight states and the District of Columbia practicing social distancing to cast ballots in key primary elections Tuesday, part of a phased reopening of public places in all 50 states. That reopening cheered here in Colorado. Its governor telling lawmakers the state needs to know what resources it will receive as it moves ahead with reopening.
If we're going to plan in coordination with our federal partners, we need to make sure we have all the cards on the table. Everybody knows exactly what we're going to get when, what we're not going to get when, and then the states try to fill in the holes.
Some state and local leaders saying the stay-at-home orders of the spring aren't an option if the virus returns in the fall.
We can't go back and say we're going to all be shut down. We've got to go into the fall, recognize there could be another wave, but we can't go back into sheltering in place. We have to be able to manage through this risk, and that is through the testing, that is through the contact tracing, and that's through the social distancing until we get a vaccine.
More than 40 million Americans have filed for unemployment since stay-at-home orders shut down large portions of the economy. Congressional Democrats say the more than $3 trillion in aid passed so far is still not enough.
I think we need a big, strong, bold bill I support COVID for.
But Senate Republicans want to pause to see how the already passed aid is working, saying they will take up consideration of more aid in July. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Survivors and family members of Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga sat in the same courtroom in Paris Wednesday, where a French court ruled on where his case will be tried. UN prosecutors accused Kabuga of bankrolling and arming ethnic Hutu militias that killed 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus in Rwanda during a 100-day period in 1994. He's been indicted for genocide and the incitement to commit genocide, among other charges. Joining us now for details on the hearing is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, tell us about how it went.
This hearing was the final decision by the Court of Appeal in Paris whether or not Félicien Kabuga can be transferred from France to the custody of the International Criminal Tribunals. The court found that, yes, he can be sent to the, what's called the mechanism, whether that will be in The Hague in the Netherlands or in Arusha, Tanzania, that has still got to be worked out. But the court said very clearly that Kabuga has no health issues that would stop him from being transferred to the mechanism. Also, there is no question in the judge's mind that he would not receive a fair trial from that court. So they rejected all those demands from the defense. They also rejected the defense application that Kabuga be released on bail. They said quite clearly he will remain in custody until such time as he gets handed over to the tribunal. He will remain in custody, no question about that. But while he is in custody, he will receive medical treatment.
And did his attorneys, how did they respond?
They responded by saying they are going to appeal this judgment. They have the right to appeal to a high French court. It's just a court, though, that looks at the legalities, makes sure that it was true to the letter of the law. They said they will also ask that he go on trial here in France. They said that they are unsure he would get a fair trial either in Tanzania or in The Hague. They feel it would be too political. That's what they're going to ask for. They say they've got precedent on their side. They now have 10 days to launch that appeal.
And what was it like in the courtroom, Catherine?
It's a very small courtroom. The main court of appeal in the center of Paris. There are only 30 people in the court, apart from the judges and the lawyers, 10 journalists, 10 members of the Rwandan community here in France, and 10 members of Félicien Kabuga's family. Some of his children were there. So you had on one side of the court journalists and members of the Rwandan community, and literally just 1 meter away, family members, children for Félicien Kabuga. When Monsieur Kabuga was brought into court, he was brought in a wheelchair. He was wearing black trousers, check shirt, and was wearing a surgical mask. He took that off during the proceedings. He coughed often during the proceedings. He spat on the floor several times. What was quite disturbing for some of the Rwandan community members who I was speaking to afterwards was that when he arrived in the court, his family members were calling out to him saying, we love you, Papa, we're with you, we're with you. And that they actually had about 5 minutes with him inside the court where they were, you know, holding hands, talking. For some of the community members here in France, they said that was difficult to have seen the family just being so openly affectionate to their father, a man who stands accused of 7 counts of genocide.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam arrived in Beijing Wednesday for meetings with central government officials about a planned national security law that could be implemented as soon as late this month. Her visit to mainland China came a day before today's June 4th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre that took place in 1989. Each year, Hong Kong residents observe the anniversary, but this year, the government has banned such gatherings. And on that eve of the anniversary, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to local journalist Ria Mogul via WhatsApp to learn about how people reacted to that decision and what's planned.
Yeah, so, you know, they announced a couple of days ago that for the first time in 30 years, the June 4th vigil in Victoria Park would not go ahead. And of course, they cited the reason for this was because of social distancing and because we're still under social distancing rules. But many people, in fact, all democracy activists and many Hong Kong people believe that this ban is quite political. They see it as a way of clamping down on what they think is an expression of their freedom, of their rights. You know, the organizers of the vigil said that they were confident that Hong Kongers would adhere to social distancing rules and gather in groups of 8 in Victoria Park. Now, bear in mind, Victoria Park is huge. It's massive. There's, you know, several football pitches, and it can hold a capacity of, last year there were about 180,000 people. So they were confident that people would camp out in little groups of eight and you know, keep to social distancing rules. And when the announcement came that the march would not be allowed to go ahead at all, people were very angry.
So if people can't meet physically, are they still planning to observe the vigil?
Yeah, so the organizers of the event are still going to gather in Victoria Park in groups of eight, and there's not many organizers. So what they're going to do is they're going to be present at Victoria Park, and they're going to live stream to, you know, whoever wants to join the online vigil, and people will be in their homes and light candles. There's also several pop-up events that I've seen on Facebook for things like readings, literary readings, where people read, you know, Chinese literature and work from activists on the mainland. So there's definitely several events happening around Hong Kong. There's going to be a lot of online activism, and I imagine people will show up to Victoria Park anyway, because we're not banned from going to public places. It's just that you have to be within groups of eight.
International Edition Steve Miller speaking with Hong Kong-based reporter Ria Mogul. Here are some of the other stories we are following from around the world. More than 600 nurses worldwide are known to have died from COVID-19, which has infected an estimated 450,000 healthcare workers, according to the International Council of Nurses. The death toll among nurses more than doubled in the past month, from 260 on May 6th. The United Kingdom's COVID-19 death toll surpassed 50,000 Wednesday, highlighting the country's place as one of the world's worst hit. The new data is a dire milestone for Prime Minister Boris Johnson as he tries to ease the stringent coronavirus lockdown. Brazilian states are bolstering the fight against destruction of the Amazon rainforest with millions of dollars from an oil company's corruption settlement that allows them to partially compensate for weakening environmental protections under President Jair Bolsonaro. The cash, which comes from a massive settlement payment from state-run oil firm Petrobras, will be spent on patrol officers, jeeps, surveillance technology, and other outlays to protect the rainforest. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. As demonstrations and vigils have continued for George Floyd across the United States, there were hymns of other painful times in the nation's history where the people rose up against racial injustice.
Not know how long it will be.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Please take care and be well.
We'll find out.